now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. A lot of these people that have all these abilities, who have celestial star ancestry, they're operating not only throughout this cosmos, but in higher planes, and they're working against the Draco Empire. The photonic energy and the cosmic rays will activate our higher centers. And it's incumbent upon us to ride that frequency wave. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you are listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. In fact, you are listening to the segment known as Bartley's Commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. Today, in the first segment, I will start off by talking about some of the background concerning the John Ford Initiative. I will be having Richard Smith, a longtime veteran UFO researcher and an old colleague of mine back in the old Night Search Paranormal Network days, way back when. We each had our own podcast shows back at the very early dawn of the podcast era. And over the years, I've followed Richard's work, and he's written a couple of books. And lately, he's been, the last several years, has really stood in the gap as far as keeping the story of John Ford alive in the public consciousness. Who is John Ford? John Ford was the director of the Long Island UFO Network. And John Ford was set up in a sting operation, and he was arrested on false charges, thrown into an insane asylum, probably drugged up, and has been in this insane asylum for 20 years now, all for the crime, if you want to call it that, of being a dogged investigator and finding out everything he could about two UFO crashes. I believe he actually investigated three UFO crashes, but the two I will talk about now. The first was Sunday, September 24th, 1989, in Mauritius Bay, and the second crash occurred at South Haven Park, Long Island, November 24th, 1992. I first became aware of the Mauritius Bay crash retrieval by reading one of Leonard Stringfield's status reports. Again, this is Mauritius Bay, Long Island, Sunday, September 24th, 1989. There had been a number of large triangular craft sightings. And according to Stringfield's sources, and according to Ford's research, John Ford believed that the operation to essentially shoot down one of these large triangular craft, which have been flying around quite frequently in the Mauritius Bay area, was planned in advance. And so I will relate to you now what I remember of Leonard Stringfield's information. Unfortunately, I don't have that particular status report. The late, great Leonard Stringfield was the pioneer in what we now refer to as UFO crash retrievals. Leonard Stringfield was a intelligence officer with the 5th Army Air Force in New Guinea and the Philippines during World War II. And Leonard Stringfield had his own sighting when he was flying in a transport plane. I can't remember if he was flying near Iwo Jima or Okinawa, but one of the island groups south of Japan proper, Stringfield saw very bright illuminated objects flying alongside the transport plane he was in, and that began a lifelong interest from that point in UFOs, flying saucers, etc. Further down the track, and Leonard Stringfield really deserves his own segment here in the commentaries on the Cosmic Wars, because Stringfield himself was such a legend. But Long and short of it was, over the years, Leonard Stringfellow developed many sources in the military and intelligence community and the private defense contractor community. And these sources had provided him firsthand information about recovered alien craft, about the alien technology being recovered, the circumstances of the recovery, where a lot of this technology wound up being taken to, the disposition of the aliens, living or dead, what bases and installations they wind the bodies of the dead aliens wound up being taken to. And over the years, before he passed away, Leonard Stringfield had put out a series of what he called status reports, basically updates on his latest information and updates of prior case studies involving the crash retrieval of alien technology. So this brings us up to speed about Leonard Stringfield. He put out a status report, and in that status report was the September 24th, 1989 Mauritius Bay, Long Island incident. And according to Leonard Stringfield's sources, I'm going by memory here, because I, you know, my various migrations, I no longer have, unfortunately, the status report. But the military had set up an operation to shoot down one of these large triangular craft. Apparently, it was some kind of directed energy weapon that was brought by the military to Mauritius Bay. Sure enough, before too long, one of these large triangular craft appeared. They fired this directed energy weapon at this craft, disabled it, it crashed, and then, according to eyewitnesses, the craft was loaded onto a very large cargo net, and then two double rotored helos. I think, if memory serves, they I can't remember really if they were Chinooks or if they were CH-53s, but anyway, at least two heavy lift helicopters, one on either side with a cargo net draped between them, and the craft sitting on the cargo net. These two helicopters hauled away the craft that was shot down. If memory serves, and it's been years since I read this status report, if memory serves, the craft was first taken to Bell Labs in New York State, and then eventually wound up at Fort Meade, Maryland, which, as many of you know, is the one of the main centers of the National Security Agency. That was the Mauritius Bay UFO crash retrieval, and what, according to Leonard Stringfield sources, stated was actually a planned and calculated effort, a successful effort to shoot down an alien craft. This is not the first time these things have happened. There have been similar instances around the world. In the late 1970s, the South African Air Force scrambled a couple of jets after a flying saucer, and they used a microwave laser cannon on board one or both of the jet interceptors to shoot down a flying saucer that crash-landed in the Kalahari Desert. That's just another example. And let's get to the South Haven. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. It looks like Southaven, South Haven Park, Long Island, the night of November 24th, 1992. A large cylindrical craft, which seemed to be experiencing some kind of technical difficulty, was observed, and the accounts vary. Some accounts, some witnesses state that the craft, it was a cylindrical shaped craft, seemed to be kind of wobbling in the air, and eventually crashed in this park, South Haven Park. Other witnesses described it tumbling end over end. Whatever the case may be, it crashed at South Haven Park, Long Island, November 24th, 1992. Within 15 minutes, a horde of black helicopters and black jeeps and utility vehicles descended on the crash site. The place was sealed off. We've heard this story before. For days and weeks afterward, there were power surges in the immediate area and the surrounding area, brownouts, blackouts, so on and so forth. So there was some kind of electromagnetic anomaly that resulted as a result of this crashed alien craft. The third crash site that John Ford had investigated, and this was in 1995, and John Ford claims that the East End forest fires had been deliberately set up to cover the crash of a large disk near Suffolk Community College, south of Riverhead, Long Island. Now, this kind of thing has happened before. I know of a case where there was a mountain. Beneath the mountain was an underground base, and in this underground base were military and alien life forms, what we would call reptilians, and they jointly shared a facility that some people I know were my labs. Military abductees were taken to this facility unwillingly, I might add, where they were worked over, utilized in medical experimentation, and utilized in training and whatnot. All I will say about this, the location of this underground base, is that it's in a small town in the Victorville Barstow area. In order to secure the location, the authorities set fire to the top of the mountain. They deliberately set a large fire in the top of the mountain, and they basically burned out a bunch of homes and rendered a lot of people homeless. And even before the dust settled and the smoke cleared, the military had erected a cyclone fence at the base of the mountain, and they put armed guards patrolling the perimeter. And basically, that's how they burned the people out, so they would no longer pose a security threat. The first firefighter units to arrive at the location came from Fort Irwin Army Base, 60 miles away. So right off the bat, that tells you that there's something wrong. So that's a third crash retrieval that John Ford had researched. The Mauritius Bay encounter, and for those in the hair splitting department, accounts vary. And again, I'm going by memory here. Some people say that a lot of the craft flying around Mauritius Bay were boomerang shaped, parabola shaped. There was the Hudson River Valley sighting wave back in the day when very large boomerangs were seen flying around, and of course in upstate New York. You have Pine Bush, where lots of triangular-shaped craft were seen. So I don't know for sure if the craft that was shot down on Mauritius Bay was boomerang-shaped or triangular-shaped. Whatever the case may be, it was shot down. And according to John Ford sources, the directed energy weapon may have been developed at Brookhaven National Labs. And again, according to Leonard Stringfield sources, the craft shot down in Mauritius Bay wound up at Fort Meade, Maryland, home of the NSA. So just a point of relevance there. John Ford had accused the authorities of deliberately setting a forest fire in order to seal off the area where a crash saucer had come down in Pine Barrens. And again, these things do happen. The special ops teams that are tasked with retrieving alien spacecraft that have become disabled or shot down routinely, it's in their training. They routinely can and are allowed to commit large blackouts. They're allowed to create large diversions. They're allowed to create roadblocks. They're Operational team members are trained in all kinds of heavy equipment, bulldozers, cranes, you name it. They get into a crash site, they retrieve what they're supposed to retrieve, and then they utilize bulldozers and other earth-moving equipment to essentially change the look of the place so it appears as if nothing happened there. I mean, a sharp observer would look down and say, well, it looks like this is like been planed out. You know, fresh dirt has been tossed in this area. It doesn't look anything like the reports that we've gotten. You know, lots of charred, churned up earth, a big furrow in the ground, et cetera, et cetera. These teams move in, retrieve the craft and the bodies, and then you use their equipment if they have time to make it seem as if nothing happened there. So I just wanted to point that out because what John Ford said about Pine Barrens and the fact that East End forest fires having been deliberately set in order to cover up the crash of a large disc near Suffolk Community College, those things happen because I know for a fact that happened to a mountain in the high desert of Southern California. It was a deliberate effort to burn off the residents who didn't want to move, I guess. I guess that was the problem. And so the military solved their problem by burning a bunch of houses down and basically wiping out a whole community. The end justifies the means, I guess. So just a little bit of confirmation there. Richard Smith has been campaigning for quite some time to draw attention to John Ford's plight. He's been in this insane asylum for 20 years now, and he is very ill. He's got a severe back problem, which was not treated by the hospital authorities. So I wanted to tell the listeners here on the Cosmic Switchboard and the Bartley's commentaries in the Cosmic Wars segment about the background to the John Ford Initiative, because these things don't happen in a vacuum. John Ford doggedly pursuing all kinds of leads, finding witnesses, and developing a timeline of events. And because of the work he was doing, he was set up in a sting operation, and Richard Smith will go into all of the gory details, but basically he was set up on a trumped-up charge of threatening local government officials in Suffolk County, Long Island. So I just wanted to talk about that in the first part of the show here. Another aspect that needs to be brought out about this treatment of John Ford is the behavior of the Mutual UFO Network. Time and again, we have seen in cases that have the potential to make a huge impact far beyond the confines of just the so-called UFO community, but even spilling out into the mainstream had MUFON done their work. Now, I'll give credit where credit's due. There has been some good MUFON investigators in the past, indeed even great individual investigators, such as the aforementioned Leonard Stringfield was a MUFON investigator. Other individuals, such as Bill Hamilton, an outstanding researcher in his own right. But what I'm talking here about here is the institution of MUFON and the fact that time and again, instead of helping get a case out to the greater public, instead of helping the key witnesses to an event, Larry Warren comes to mind. Larry Warren was, to my mind, thus far, still the only eyewitness at the Rendlesham Forest Bentwaters events in, ironically enough, Suffolk County, England. I just mentioned Suffolk, Long Island, but Bentwaters, RAF Woodbridge, twin bases there in Suffolk County, England, has been the site of repeated alien intrusions as well as related underground ET activity and related underground black ops military activity, which at times in various parts of the world the twain sometimes meets, sometimes quite often, where deep black elements of the military aerospace community are working in collusion with one or more factions of non-human intelligences, let's say. Well, MUFON, instead of doing everything it could to help Larry Warren, the only guy thus far who's publicly talked about the alien component about Bentwaters, RAF Woodbridge, Rendlesham Forest, another name for these key events, in December, late December 1980, instead of helping Larry Warren, MUFON became a hindrance, one of Larry Warren's chief detractors. And this was from the top down, from Walt Andrus, who was the director of MUFON at the time, all the way down to a number of key individuals throughout MUFON. Instead of helping Larry Warren, they basically vilified him. The point of relevance to the John Ford case is, instead of being a help to John Ford in the early stages of these investigations, MUFON once again proved to be a hindrance. And they are nowhere to be seen as far as bringing light to the sad plight of John Ford. They have not campaigned on his behalf. They have not launched a crusade on his behalf. And I must say the same thing about the disclosure movement, the so-called UFO disclosure movement, which I always thought of as a joke anyway. Exopolitics, same thing. When it comes to the plight of John Ford, those two, I guess you want to call them groups or communities, are nowhere to be seen. MUFON is a hindrance to the actual exposure of the real depth of the alien reality here on this planet. They time and again want to stick to nuts and bolts, lights in the sky crap, rather than sink their teeth into the real nitty-gritty. Again, this is not an across-the-board statement. There are individual MUFON researchers who are worthy of the name UFO investigators. But as an institution, as a whole, MUFON has proven time and again to be a hindrance to breaking very big UFO cases. And another thing that manifested around the John Ford situation is when other independent UFO researchers, such as Elaine Douglas, the late Elaine Douglas, who I know and I communicated with some time ago, several years back. She since passed away. But Elaine Douglas was a member of MUFON, and she made efforts at helping John Ford, exposing his plight, exposing the inherent injustice of his incarceration and his arrest and the trumped-up charges, etc., etc. So what does MUFON do? Instead of MUFON having the back of Elaine Douglas, a MUFON investigator, MUFON basically demonizes Elaine Douglas, makes it so difficult for Elaine Douglas to operate. Elaine Douglas basically leaves MUFON. So we have yet another example of the Mutual UFO Network becoming a part of the problem rather than a part of the solution. And unfortunately, with some of these large UFO groups, this is often the case. So keep that in mind. I've had so-called MUFON investigators look me in the eyes and say, I don't believe in alien abductions. And I'm thinking, then, what the hell are you doing here? Who are you really working for? Because if you don't believe in alien abductions, if you don't believe in encounters with alien beings, and that's where the rubber meets the road, is the encounter cases. And there are countless people all over the world who've had encounters with ETs, including Larry Warren, in not only in his personal life as an alien abductee, but as a member of the Air Force security element that was working at Bentwaters at that time. A number of Air Force security personnel witnessed the ETs on the third night of the events. For whatever reason, most of the other, well, in fact, all of the other witnesses don't want to talk about the ET element. They only want to talk about lights in the sky and lights moving along in the woods and a landed craft here or there, which they may have stood around or examined or looked at briefly, but they don't want to talk about the ET element because there has always been a long-standing anti-ET bias in mainstream ufology. We see this again and again and again. The famous Travis Walton case. Mainstream ufologists basically turned their back on Travis Walton. They didn't want to hear about a guy who disappeared for 5 days. Colleagues of his had witnessed Travis within close proximity of a flying saucer. In fact, close colleagues took off. They fled the scene and left poor Travis there to deal with the consequences. He was abducted and wound up gone for 5 days. And once again, mainstream ufologists, instead of being interested in such a case, they not only turn their back on it, even worse, they denigrate the character of Travis Walton. And we've seen this again and again and again from mainstream researchers and mainstream ufologists, and especially the large UFO research groups. This anti-alien bias of mainstream ufology is curious, to say the least. One of the best books I've ever read, it was actually an anthology. A number of researchers from around the world had contributed chapters to a book called The Humanoids. And this came out, if memory serves, in the late 60s. The Humanoids is all about encounters with aliens, and many of the chapters, many of the accounts deal with landed craft, occupants of said craft outside the landed craft. A craft of some sort, a saucer, let's say, landed in a field, and then the eyewitnesses see one or more ETs outside of the craft, exiting the craft, entering the craft, getting back into the craft, and the craft flying away. Landed craft, occupants seen outside of the craft. In the case of the Lonnie Zamora case, Lonnie Zamora was a New Mexican state policeman. This was the famous Socorro, New Mexico case where Lonnie Zamora heard a loud, what he thought was an explosion in the vicinity of a shed where dynamite was kept. So he drove to the area where he thought he heard the explosion, and he spied an egg-shaped craft on the ground and two ETs outside of the craft. Apparently there was something wrong with the craft, and the two ETs were checking out the hull of the craft and looking it over. The ETs got back into the craft, and the craft lifted off and made kind of a roaring sound and flew away. There was physical traces left, what the so-called legitimate science-oriented UFO researchers refer to as a landing trace case. There were depressions made from the landing gear. There were metal pieces, anomalous metallic pieces. There was a whole book written about this case. But I only bring it up to show how common in the old days, I wouldn't say common is not the right word, but it was not unusual, especially in the 50s. There was a large UFO wave in France, and many people had seen landed craft occupants outside the craft. And then you have someone like Lonnie Zamora, veteran police officer in New Mexico, seen an egg-shaped craft, seen two little ETs outside the craft, apparently working on the craft. But yet, when Larry Warren rocks up and says, I saw a landed craft and ETs come out of it, oh, the mainstream ufologists don't want to hear it. Despite the number of cases in the past, when, again, I'm sounding redundant, but I'm doing this intentionally, landed craft, occupants seen outside of the craft, find the book The Humanoids, a classic book in the UFO literature, in the UFO field. Many, many, many cases of a landed craft and occupants seen outside of the craft. But once again, the mainstream UFO bias towards aliens. And that's why to this day, switching gears here, alien abductions, encounters with aliens, that kind of thing is still anathema to many mainstream ufologists. On the one hand, I believe there's this pathetic need to be accepted. There's this pathetic need amongst the part of certain UFO researchers, indeed UFO organizations, to be acceptable to the mainstream, to be acceptable to the bogus scientific community. I don't believe in mainstream science. I think it's all bogus. I think Einstein was a fraud. He was a patent clerk in Switzerland. And suddenly, after his emergence, after he was pushed in front of the world media, afterwards, people were using Einstein's name as a synonym for genius. Oh, he thinks he's another Einstein. And in my view, it was a deliberate effort on the part of the powers that be to move people away from ether physics, to move people away from the original type of science where metaphysics, mysticism, and science combined as a unified whole. And by propping up Einstein, the mathematicians take over. The mathematicians don't really have any proof. They're the ones that have taken over physics in many ways. Their only proof, often as not, is a long-ass equation on a blackboard. That's their proof. As the grunts in Vietnam used to say, it don't mean nothing. And so you'll hear these lamestream astrophysicists go on and on and on about the vast distances between star systems, blah, 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 quack, quack, quack. And many of these people that fancy themselves UFO researchers, and really they're just poking a stick at the subject, just poking a stick at it. It's more of a hobby level commitment than anything. It's not a passion for these people. I interviewed way back when in the Night Search Paranormal Network days, NSPN, the head of MUFON at the time was John Schuessler. And I interviewed John Schuessler on my show. He was on there specifically to talk about the Cash Landrum case. The Cash Landrum case is a classic in the field of UFO research, a very tragic case. All the participants, Cash Landrum, and then the young boy who's now an adult, they were all severely irradiated because they got too close to a diamond-shaped UFO that left a huge scorch mark on the pavement in a lonely, deserted highway outside of Houston, Texas. And again, someone came along and changed that section of the highway, tore out the scorched part of the highway, and repaved it with a new section of highway so as to make it appear as if nothing happened there. John Schuessler came on the show specifically to talk about the Cash Landrum case, but he also made some other points. And he said one of his edicts that he issued upon taking the reins of MUFON was he wanted his investigators to focus on the high strangeness cases. I'll repeat that. He wanted the investigators to focus on high strangeness cases. And I would say that, well, better late than never. Sometimes it takes a while for the coin to drop for some people. Because the high strangeness cases is where we get the most information. Not from little soil samples, although that can lead to scientific anomalies and curiosities. For example, some landing sites, UFO landing sites, the soil retrieved from there can no longer absorb water. Okay, that's a very interesting, unusual, anomalous finding. Some samples from landing sites may give off a higher than normal background radiation count, also very interesting. Interesting to people like me, but to the lamestream public, it doesn't mean anything. And I have long since got over this need to convince people about anything. My information is geared specifically for those who have had UFO ET experiences, as well as for those who are straddling the fence. They know there's something. These are people that know there's something just beyond the five-sense conspiracy. They want to know more. I'm not the guru. I'm not the all-knowing, all-wise, omniscient guru figure. All I can do is share what little I know and plant seeds and encourage others to do their own research. So John Schussler had to basically order his investigators worldwide, because MUFON is an international organization, John Schussler had to order, essentially, his investigators worldwide to focus on the high strangeness cases. Call me cynical, call me somewhat jaded, but a real UFO investigator should not have to be told to seek out and investigate the high strangeness cases. What Schussler was really saying was, don't be scared of them. The high strangeness cases freaked out the more mainstream, bogus science-oriented investigators, because there was no way they could wrap their minds around the high strangeness cases. To my mind, a true investigator should never have to be told to investigate the high strangeness cases. Those are the ones that the investigator should be seeking out. Here are just a few examples, well known in the field, and some of these examples will come from my own personal memory banks, discussions I have had with colleagues and friends. These are just some of the observed aspects, observed capabilities of alien spacecraft. They can modularize, i.e., they can divide up into two or more parts and operate independently of one another. They can even rejoin. There are numerous cases of two or more craft flying at each other at high speed and merging. In the famous Bentwaters case, the memo written by Charles Hart, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Hart, and make no mistake about it, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Hart is a limited hangout, low-hanging fruit, if you will. He was there in at least two of the nights at Bentwaters, and he saw a lot more than lights moving around in the woods. He wrote a carefully crafted memo, which is still regarded in the field of UFO research as being one of the key pieces of evidence and proof of a high-level military intelligence interest in the UFO subject. And in his account, which he wrote, and also there was the famous Halt tape, where, again, I believe parts of that tape were either completely cut out or edited out. The Halt memo, which Lieutenant Colonel Charles Halt wrote after the fact, in fact, quite a while after the fact, he described UFOs doing a number of things. In the memo, he specifically described how one of the craft overhead split up into numerous parts and flew in different directions. We saw the same thing in Puerto Rico. I recently had the great Puerto Rican investigator Jorge Martin on my show, and he talked about a case when a very large triangular-shaped craft was pursued by two Navy F-14 Tomcats. The large triangular craft, I'm trying to get the sequence of events right, emitted a large red orb or orbs, which were meant to frighten and chase away the pilots of the F-14 Tomcats. And at a certain point, the large triangular craft split up into, I can't remember if it was two or three parts, but let's just say two parts. And the two parts flew off in different directions. So how does lamestream science describe or explain that? you can write the longest equation in the world on a stretch of wall like mathematical graffiti. You still cannot explain that. Some things in, as far as the lamestream bogus science is concerned, are simply unquantifiable. In the famous jet chase of Iran, when was this, 1976, 1977 time frame, the Defense Intelligence Agency wrote a memo based on the report of its attaché or its sources in Tehran, Iran. Here's the story. There was a very large ET craft, brilliantly illuminated, described as just basically lighting up the night sky, was seen to be flying over Tehran. This is at the time of the Shah, the puppet pedophile dictator installed by the U.S. The pedophile Shah Pahlavi was installed after Mossadegh was ousted by the U.S. and British intelligence. British intelligence CIA joint operation, and they installed the puppet Shah of Iran. And he created the SAVAK, his internal security apparatus, the dreaded SAVAK, with the U.S. and Israeli help. But anyway, fast forward to 1976, and the Iranians were the beneficiary of a lot of U.S. military foreign aid, and they flew, their Iranian Air Force flew Phantoms, which were developed by McDonnell Douglas. And the Iranian Air Force scrambled, if memory serves, two F-4 Phantoms at this very large UFO that was lighting up the night sky in Tehran, over Tehran. And all this was mentioned in that Defense Intelligence Agency memo. And what was interesting was the memo describes how smaller craft were sent out of the larger craft and basically engaged the F-4 Phantoms. And I heard the radio transmissions from the Iranian Air Force pilot shown on the great Fox Network show Sightings in the 1990s, early 2000 time frame. That was an outstanding show about not just UFOs, but a variety of other mysterious subjects. And they had a translation subtitle at the bottom of the screen, and they showed a reenactment of the intercept of the Iranian Air Force F-4 Phantoms vectored towards this huge craft. Both pilots began to have electromagnetic interference, very common, and one of the pilots said, "I'm frightened," and I would say, no doubt, because he's being ordered by his masters to fly straight at a big, honking, brightly illuminated craft, and he's starting to experience electromagnetic difficulties. His avionics and his radio were starting to experience difficulties, and then on top of that, the big ship sends out one or more smaller craft to mess with him, right? So eventually the pirates are ordered to go back, and then the smaller craft that were sent out of the larger craft returned into the larger craft. And it should be noted that many times people have described these larger craft in the old days, let's say 40s, 50s, 60s time frame, the cigar-shaped craft were frequently seen and regarded as motherships, where a number of smaller saucer-shaped craft would come out of one or both ends and then fly back into the cigar-shaped craft later. What eyewitnesses have seen is that oftentimes the smaller craft, they simply enter through the side of the larger craft. They don't seek out an opening like you see in Battlestar Galactica, where they have to align their smaller craft and basically land through like a large opening in the side of the craft and, come to a skidding halt. These UFOs, they can just fly right through the craft without slowing down. So that is something that's very interesting. In the wake of the Iranian Air Force incident, in order to calm down the Iranian military, and particularly the Iranian Air Force, the U.S. sends over Air Force senior attaché from the Iranian embassy to the Iranian military authorities to calm them down. Who do they send? None other than career criminal General Richard Secord of Iran-Contra infamy. If memory serves, he was up to no good in Laos in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War. So I just thought that it was just a little ironic that the U.S. would send over Richard Secord, a guy who honed lying and deceit to a fine art, to calm down the Iranians who were freaking out about this huge UFO that violated their airspace. The point of relevance is yet another example of before I spoke about these craft splitting up into different parts and flying away in different directions. Here is an example of smaller craft seen to exit a larger craft and then rejoin said larger craft, and there are many such examples. Another thing that's interesting about UFOs is a true alien craft is they violate, they visibly can violate known laws of physics, certainly optical physics. For example, there is the telescoping light effect that a number of UFOs have been seen to exhibit. And what I mean by that is there's either a stationary, hovering, or slowly moving craft relatively low in the atmosphere. And in our example, it would be dusk or nighttime, early dawn, something like that, when it's still not too bright out. And what the eyewitness or eyewitnesses see is the craft begins to descend a slowly moving light to the surface. It's not an instantaneous beam of light, as when one turns on his or her car headlights or turns on a flashlight, a torch, as our friends would say in the UK and Australia. That's an instantaneous beam of light. No, what I'm talking about is a light that slowly descends, the way an elevator would, or a lift going down, slowly descends to the surface. This violates just so many laws of optical light physics as currently understood by lamestream physics. Likewise, the craft can then retract said light. The light retracts and ascends back up into the craft. It's not a case of the craft simply turning the light off and the light disappearing. No, the light beam retracts and ascends back up into the craft. Okay, that's not explainable by modern physics. No mathematical equation, however lengthy, can explain that. Another thing that's interesting is that there is a spatial anomaly involved with many alien craft encounters. What I mean by that is what could seem to be a relatively small craft on the outside, and the accounts and witness statements vary, and the accounts have come over the years from military insiders who took part in crash retrievals or analysis of recovered alien craft that were brought back to some secret facility, as well as the accounts of ordinary alien contactees and alien abductees and alien mylabs, alien abduction mylabs. And what these people describe is that although the craft may seem to appear to be of a certain finite size on the outside, say 30 feet or smaller, when they went inside the craft was much larger. It would seem to the percipient that in one case, one of Leonard Stringfield's cases, actually it was a guy who phoned in to a radio show, I think in Los Angeles, when Leonard Stringfield was being interviewed, talking about his crash retrieval cases. An anonymous caller called in and said he was, if memory serves, an ex-Marine Corps member, and that he was called out to a UFO crash site. He'd never done anything like this before, never took part in anything like this before. Long story short, he says that on the outside, the saucer was about 30-some-odd feet in diameter. But when he peered inside, he did a double take because it seemed that the interior of that craft was at least from one end to another, he said, at least 2 football fields long. And then he did a double take. He pulled his head back out, looked at the craft that he was actually touching, looked around. Yep, it still looks like it's about 30 feet, diameter on the outside, sticks his head in, and he sees that it's about 2 football fields in length, at least. That's as far as he could see anyway. And he, if memory serves, he also describes the second time he looked in there, seeing people walking out in hazmat suits with breathing apparatus coming out from the inside of the craft. And a good buddy of mine has had a lifetime's worth of encounters. Oftentimes, it seems that the stories he tells me, he seems to be involved with more benevolent, friendly types of ETs. And in one of the experiences, he was outside of a small landed craft. So did he say it was a craft? It was a sphere, I think. It was some kind of white sphere. And it was sitting on the grass, and it was only about 5 feet high or smaller, right? And in fact, they may even be on the larger side. It could have been not much bigger than a beach ball or a medicine ball. And there was an ET standing outside of this sphere that was sitting on the grass. And the ET told my friend, go ahead and put your head inside of that. And, my friend was kind of taken aback. He goes, well, what do you mean by that? And the ET just told him, just go ahead and put your head inside of it. So he did. He went ahead and he reluctantly poked his head through the exterior of the sphere. His head went inside without any resistance at all. And when he stuck his head inside, the inside was cavernous. It was humongous. I think if memory serves, he said something to the effect like he couldn't see how far the interior extended. And like the previous military guy I described, ex-military guy, my friend pulled his head out, looked around, and noticed that, yeah, on the outside, it's like this relatively small sphere. Yet, when he sticks his head inside, he did it again. He put his head inside, and it was a humongous interior. So that's an example of these ET races having an ability to control their space, to manipulate space. And I'm reminded of what the ETs that Betty Andreas, and nowadays her name is Betty Luca, but many of us in the field go way back. We remember her as Betty Andreas, because of the books, The Andreasen Affair, The Andreasen Affair 2, then The Watchers and The Watchers 2, written by Raymond Fowler, an outstanding UFO investigator himself, former member of the Air Force Security Service, a contractor for, I think, Sylvania, if memory serves. And he himself was an alien abductee, alien contactee, and he wrote a series of books about Betty Andreasen. And Betty Andreasen talked about her encounters with a certain group of ETs. Her books give great insight into the culture of a particular alien race, because Betty Andreasen had a photographic memory and was also an artist, so she can draw the things that she was describing that sound kind of vague under hypnosis or in full waking consciousness, her descriptions. And she was told by the aliens that what's important is space. Space. not outer space, but space in general. And that statement always stuck with me. And then I started hearing of these accounts of this relatively small exteriors of craft, and then the interiors being humongous, being gigantic. It bespeaks the mastery that some of these beings have with what we call space. And getting back to lamestream, bogus, egghead science, how does one explain that? There are other such examples in the field, too numerous to count. Betty Andreessen was one of those people that talked about how the aliens seem to be able to put people in freeze frame, stop motion, during an abduction. They came to her house, they hauled her out. In fact, if memory serves, they passed her right through the front door. And she saw the Greys. It was a faction of the Greys. She saw them phase shift. In other words, it was like, imagine seeing an image of one person repeated a few or several times. When they were about to go through solid objects, these ETs seemed to be able to, what I'm thinking she did was witness them change their density, because she would start to see like multiple versions of the entity, but as they went down the line, each entity would be more and more transparent, if you will, or less corporeal. It seemed that they kind of had to go through this phase shifting mode, at least some of them, some of the time, before they walked through solid objects. But sometimes, a lot of times, aliens don't even need to do that. They just walk through a solid object, especially if they have technology at hand. Some of these ETs wear utility belts, even, where they press a button and disappear or teleport somewhere else. So Betty Andreessen talked about the ability of these ETs to stop freeze frame everyone else except the person they're abducting. And she was let out of the house. She saw these aliens pass through the front door, and in either that case or another case Betty described, she saw them kind of, you know, phase shifting, basically, and pass through a solid object. We've heard this many times, not only from alien abductees, but from people who saw this occur in a populated area, like in a city plaza or a busy street, where an alien craft shows up and everyone is stuck in freeze frame mode except the percipient. And everything within that field, that energetic field, is in freeze frame. Birds. One of the very common characteristic of the approach or the close proximity of an alien craft is the vacuum stillness described by percipients, where they say, suddenly, I couldn't hear any insects. I couldn't hear any sound. It was as if I was in a vacuum or hermetically sealed chamber. So that's another aspect, the ability of the craft and the ETs to stall out and instantaneously cut out engine motors, car motors, machinery, the low-level incursions over strategic command, air command missile bases and missile silos. And understand, these silos are spread out over many, many miles, over a vast distance. They have to spread them out in the event of a ground strike of a thermonuclear weapon, so-called survivability. They want these missiles to be spaced far enough apart, so if one silo gets nuked, the others, if they're still in their silos, won't be harmed. Well, these UFOs have the ability to thoroughly mess with the electronics and the circuitry and the computer systems, the onboard navigation systems of the missiles. Not only do they create a no-go status, what the Air Force Strategic Air Command referred to as a fated giant situation, when a nuclear missile suddenly goes into no-go status. Robert Salas, he was at, if memory serves, Malmstrom Air Force Base 66, I think. He was in a launch control facility. He didn't actually see what was going on, but he was told this from the outside. In fact, all the activity occurred outside. He was inside of a launch control facility, and I can't remember if it was 16 or if it was 22, but a large number of nuclear missiles went into no-go fated giant status because of the influence exerted upon the nuclear missiles by alien craft that were flying over the missile sites and also hovering over them. Linda Moulton Howe talks about a case, I think it was also in Malmstrom, but it may have been a different year, when one particular nuclear missile was put in a no-go status by a low-flying alien craft. And when they checked out the navigation, avionics, everything else, they found out that the onboard navigation computer had been damaged. The onboard navigation computer dictates where that missile will fly to obliterate its target. Something was done to the nuclear missile's navigation computer that rendered it null and void. They had to take the missile out of the silo to repair it. Those are just examples of how alien craft can mess with not just car motors and not just cause blackouts. I was laying in my bed one time in San Diego, California, a light beam. It was dusk. It was, you know, getting towards Thanksgiving in November, and I stayed home from work that day. I had some kind of a bug. And sometimes you have to look at the humorous side of things. I was laying on my bed. The headboard was beneath the windowsill. The windowsill looked out into a cul-de-sac, and beyond the cul-de-sac was a canyon. And there's a lot of canyons in San Diego County. And I'm laying there. My lights were on in the bedroom, and suddenly the lights go out in the whole neighborhood. I'm thinking, aliens, right? Blackout. Short while later, a light beam comes in from through the open window and hits the wall next to where the front of the door was that leads out into the hallway, right? And so I immediately think, okay, UFO activity. I get up and I'm kneeling down, looking with my elbows on the windowsill, looking out the window. And what do I see? Across the canyon, and now the whole neighborhood is dark, across the canyon is a utility pole with a power transformer, and around it, buzzing around and flying around it, were orange, bluish, at times orange orbs that some of them were emitting light beams across the canyon and onto the driveway down below. I was on a second story window that overlooked the driveway and by extension overlooked the canyon. So I've got a bird's eye view of this. Now, what I stupidly did, I shouldn't have done it. What I should have done was walk out onto the edge of the cul-de-sac and the very edge of the canyon to get a better look. Instead, I wasted all my time running around looking for sports binoculars. And basically, you know, I got so caught up in that I missed out on the rest. But again, that's an example of these little orbs, these brightly colored orbs, not only setting off a power outage in a whole neighborhood, but these little orbs, and there were several, they were flying all around, buzzing around this utility pole. Some of them were sending light beams, and I'm sure one of them was the one that sent the light beam through my window onto my wall after it caused a blackout. Now, when a skeptic or a lamestream science-oriented UFO researcher says something like, oh, that's impossible, that can't happen. Well, says who? For someone to say that the things I just described are impossible, that's okay, I'll spell it out for you. That's not scientific, all right? That's not scientific. To say that what I just described was impossible, that's a theory based on an opinion. That's all that is. It's a theory based on an opinion. And in the next hour, I'm going to talk about what alien abductees and contactees describe, because again, it just puts paid to the whole notion that there's any place for lamestream egghead science in the field of alien research. It's like trying to cram a square peg into a round hole. So we've reached the end of the first segment of Bartley's commentaries on the cosmic wars, and we'll meet you at the top of the next hour.